my pleasure today to introduce Julie Keene. She's an assistant professor in human-centered design and engineering, and she has an adjunct appointment with the high school as well as computer sciences. And Julie is an expert in usability, mobile devices, and is going today to talk about just the burden of using and testing mobile devices on consumers and users. So, welcome.
Thanks.
It's good to be back. I think I talked to you guys, at least this group, maybe a year ago. So, a lot of you, this is not news to a lot of you, but there's been a lot of promise and hype about the use of technology for health and well-being. So, we're hearing all sorts of benefits, like it might save time and effort, or you might save money. That's always a big thing in health these days. It can allow for things like continuous self-monitoring, so showing people trends over time to understand themselves a bit better. It's possibly easier to use than traditional maybe paper-based methods or other sorts of ways of recording this information. It might remove the needs for frequent visits to healthcare professionals, and overall, it's going to lead to miraculous health outcomes. So I say this with a little bit of sarcasm because I'm sure to this group you probably know that we haven't quite met this vision yet. So there's a lot of promise for these things, but we haven't quite gotten to all these amazing things that technology seemed to possibly be able to do. And so through a lot of my work, we've actually been uncovering some of the reasons for why these things have not come into view as much as we would have liked. So through a lot of the work, I've started to uncover the different burdens that these sorts of health technologies place on consumers or patients in terms of why they don't use these or why they might start to use them but not use them long term. So I've kind of mapped out the burdens onto to six different types here. So the first one is a physical burden. So for a physical burden, a lot of times these types of technologies might place some sort of burden on the user in terms of something that they have to wear or something that's uncomfortable. This is a picture of a pediatric patient going through a sleep study. So he's expected to actually fall asleep in an unfamiliar environment with all of these things strapped all over his body. So it's got EKG, it's got he's got a chest strap on, he has a pulse oximeter strapped to his finger. I'm not sure if he's got this on, but a lot of times also strap something to your leg to make sure that if you have a restless leg, then that can come up under there. And this is okay for diagnosing things like sleep apnea because you're only expected to do it for one night, so you can actually diagnose that in a single night. But for more behavioral-based things, people aren't going to do this for every single night for many years to get long-term trends for things like more behavioral things like insomnia or delayed sleep phase syndrome or other types of things. Likewise, some of the more commercial products, this is a medical example, so it's a little bit extreme, but even some of the more commercial products along the same lines still have some of that physical burden. So this here is a picture of the Zio, which is a commercially available sleep sensor that requires the user to wear a headband to bed every night. I've tried this out, and it's actually still uncomfortable, even though it's nothing compared to the sleep sensor, but it actually leaves a mark on your forehead, and a lot of times it'll fall off in the middle of the night. I was reading through reviews on Amazon, and people were reporting the same thing. I left a big dent in my forehead. I think it was on too tight. It was hard to get just right. So there's a lot of problems even with these more commercially based things. There's also mental burdens associated with these things. So if anyone's tried to use any sort of food journals, this is the Weight Watchers online system. And it's a lot of effort to try and go through and learn the system. What is a point? How do you calculate it? What are all the things I have? And how do I calculate what those points are? And then having to think about not only how to do that, but then having to remember to do that over time. So every time I eat something, every single bite I put in my mouth has to be entered into this journal. So there's a lot of mental effort associated with doing these sorts of things. Even things that are supposed to be simple, I'll still have that mental burden. So this is the Fitbit, which can be used for sleep tracking as well. And normally you wear it like this, you clip it onto your belt, and it's kind of tracking your activity through the day. But if you want to track it for sleep, you have to take it off, put it on a wristband, and then you have to hold down the button to say, I'm starting sleep now. Then when you wake up in the morning, you have to stop it, hold down the button again to say, I've stopped sleeping now. So even though it's a pretty simple interaction, a lot of people just don't remember to do this or forget to do this. When you're about to go to sleep at night, usually the last thing you want to do is try to record these sorts of things. Oh, did I push the button? Oh, crap, I forgot. Same thing with when you wake up in the morning. The first thing, when I wake up in the morning, I want to get my coffee and get a shower. I'm not remembering to take it off, stop the button, push those sorts of things. So even things that are somewhat simple still have this mental burden of having to remember them. There's also emotional burdens associated with different health technologies. So one kind of classic example is through Nintendo's Wii Fit. So it's an exercise application that you step on a weighted balance board, and it can tell you your weight, it asks you your height, and then it just presents your results to you on this, you know, the BMI scale, and will tell you if you're obese. And a lot of times this may be the first time people are hearing this. They thought they might have been just playing a game. It also makes it even worse because it makes your little character look fat as soon as you go above normal range. So it takes a normally skinny person and inflates you and makes you look fat. There's been a lot of reports of this being problematic, it's telling children that they're obese. People are obviously very sensitive about their weight and they don't want to be told these sorts of things through technology. Even if it's kind of more of an innocent thing, Nintendo claims that theirs is solely for entertainment, so that's how they can get away with doing this. But if someone's been tracking something for a long time, you would hopefully want to see some sort of, especially if you're trying lots of interventions. So this is a graph showing someone's sleep score from the Zio sleep recording tool over time. And they put it on there, they mapped it out, they're doing all this effort to try and improve their sleep, cutting back on caffeine, trying to get regular sleep times, and they look at this and they still see a negative downward trend. And to someone who's seen that, that can be really emotionally burdensome. So seeing that they put all this effort in and have gotten little results to show for it can be problematic. There's also a financial burden. So even though these sorts of technologies might supposedly help save us time, that might not always, or save us money, that may not always be the case. So a sleep study, like the one I showed in the first screen, can cost between $1,000 to $5,000 for a single night. So that's not something that's going to be useful for people. Sometimes your insurance covers it, not always. That can be problematic to actually try and pay for those sorts of things. But even in the consumer health space, there's a lot of smartphone apps that are out there. And this is the cheapest plan that I've found available right now. I had to look this up for a grant. But this is actually Walmart's plan. So you can pay $500 for the smartphone and then $45 a month for unlimited service. And that's the cheapest thing available. So for a lot of people, this is actually beyond their budget. They can't afford these sorts of things. They can't afford the monthly plan. So a lot of these applications are still cost prohibitive for a lot of populations. There's also time burdens associated with this. Again, with the food journal, there's the mental burden of having to figure it out and remember to do it, but it also just takes a lot of time. So a lot of times you're eating on the run, many of you are eating in class, or you don't have time to actually go to lunch and take the time to sit down and do those things. So we just don't have the time to do the types of recording that might be helpful for that. Even the somewhat simpler things still run out of time as well. So I've been using an application called Track Your Happiness that will send you text messages and make you fill out it's supposed to be a quick, maybe 2 to 5 minute survey at least 3 times a day over the course. I think they want 50 samples, and they do that every 6 months. So the first time I did it, it was great. It was during summer, there wasn't a lot going on, I was able to do it pretty regularly. Now I'm actually a new mom and have been traveling and trying to work at the same time, and it came up again just this last month, and I have missed 2/3 of the messages. So I just saw it and I was like, oh, I don't have time for this. Came up, I know it only takes 2 minutes, I just didn't have time to open it up and track it in that sort of way. So even these sort of things that are supposed to be quick and easy can be prohibitive if we just don't have the time to do it. And finally, there's also the privacy burdens associated with these sorts of technologies. So this is an example of a visualization that the Fitbit activity tracker can show you over time. And so you can have this nice detailed vision of your activity throughout the day. But you'll notice there's a spike in activity between noon and 2 p.m. And that may be great. Oh, someone went for a run, good for them. But what if they're supposed to be working during that time? And this is something that might be sharing on their social network sites, and their boss sees it, and they say, like, wait, I thought you were supposed to be working. What are you doing, doing those sorts of things when you were supposed to be in the office doing, even though that might be something to celebrate, these sorts of things could be potentially invasive. And also things like the Body Media recording tool that, if you've ever seen the show Biggest Loser, all the contestants on the show wear these to track their activity levels. And so this has almost become sort of a symbol for wanting to lose weight. So if people have walked around and been wearing these sorts of things, and people are like, oh, you must be trying to lose a few pounds if you see this on their arm. So those sorts of things can be potentially burdens to people trying to use these technologies. So My thought is that lots of people have been trying to go for the benefits of these things, kind of raise the ceiling of trying to do all those things that I talked about, but instead let's try and lower the barrier to entrance. So because a lot of times these things require time, using them over time, in order to get to those perceived benefits. So if we're not even getting them in the door in the first place because of all these different burdens, then we're never going to get to see those benefits. So my thought is that if we can reduce these different types of burdens associated with these technologies, we might get us closer to those envisioned benefits that I talked about in the beginning. So how am I hoping to do this? So I'm not saying I've got the solution to all of these things. They're obviously a very complex problem, but the research for a lot of the students in my lab has been starting to explore some of these burdens and trying to understand why they're there and what we might be able to do to sort of account for those things. So we've done a number of different formative studies, mostly kind of qualitative in nature, trying to understand these burdens and what people are facing and why they might actually, what's preventing them from using these things, and how can we possibly address those through design? So I'm going to talk about these three studies really briefly. The first one is on empathic interface design. So this is the emotional burdens that I was telling you about. So we're designing a system for, which I'll talk about later, for helping parents track developmental progress in their young children. And we're presented with this way of, well, how do we show that over time? So for, 90% of the people who use the system, their children's going to be developing normally, and it's not going to be an issue. But for that 10% of the population where you might actually be seeing that maybe negative trend towards positive development, how do we present that to the people in a way that's not going to be scary or make them anxious or worried? We came in with the design question of how do we design interfaces that potentially convey bad health news? So my two students interviewed a number of doctors and patients who have gone through the process of either giving a diagnosis of a serious disorder, so things like diabetes or cancer or Parkinson's disease, as well as patients who have received those diagnoses, to understand what their strategies were in terms of telling that news to people from the patient's perspective, what they learned that helped them understand and take that information. And they also went through and reviewed the medical training recommendations. So when a doctor is going through, or a medical student is going through med school, what are the recommendations that they do to help them share that news with others? I won't go through all the details of this, but basically people wanted the information. They didn't want the information hidden from them. We don't definitely want to hide that information from anyone in any way, but they'd like to be it presented in a way that's more sensitive to the facts. So just things like acknowledging that this may be hard information to take. Maybe you got a positive test result for a pregnancy screening that came up as a higher probability, rather than just presenting it as results abnormal, which actually happened to one of our patients. So maybe acknowledging and say a lot of people will get these sorts of results. We want to make sure that you have the information here and how to interpret them correctly. So providing the results along with the information that they might need. And also just simple things like using a we-based language, so talking about how we're a team, we're going to help you take this information in. So there's just a lot of these simple strategies that doctors use that we might be able to integrate into the design of technologies. The second thing we wanted to investigate was the privacy burden. So I've done a lot of work relating to sleep technologies, and the bedroom can be a pretty private place, as well as the home. So in a sleep lab, you're there, lots of people are watching you. But in a home, there's a lot of things that go on that you don't necessarily want people to know about. And so it's hard to ask people to say, think of all the times that you wouldn't want recorded. Obviously people in an interview may be able to list a couple things, but it's hard if you're not doing that in a contextual way. My student went and did a cultural probe to try and understand and prompt people on these things to reflect on these more in context. So what she developed were a set of what she calls sensor proxies, and all they are it's a little bit hard to see with the light here, but they're just those stick-on lights that are motion-activated, so things you might stick in a closet if you don't have a light, so the motion activates and the light turns on. So she gave 12 different families these and 4 different ones and asked them to stick them around their house, and every time the light went off, they had a journal that they could record in and talk about, okay, what was I just doing right before that got triggered, and would I have wanted that to be recorded? So ask them to sort of reflect on their thoughts there. And so we also had cameras that could take pictures of the surrounding environment. And we also had a log book of all the guests that had come into their house that also saw these things. And we looked at sort of the receptiveness to these sorts of things that go into the home. And so there's a lot of mental burdens associated with that we didn't previously encounter. So just having to remember all the situations that might come up. Things like a service worker had come in. Do I tell them that I have a recording tool in there? you know, those sorts of situations. There's a child who, you know, had seen the light and actually sort of liked it as a nightlight. and that, you know, that child actually kept reflecting on that and you know, saying, you know, I like having the nightlight there. So it was interesting that if they saw a perceived benefit, they were okay with it. But a lot of times they were having to remember all these sorts of things that were happening in all these situations. And then they didn't really understand necessarily the threats to privacy. So we did a patient education session with them in the beginning where we talked about the different types of recording that might be out there and how, you know, people might be able to use this. And at first, what initially sounded like it was okay, like, oh, I wouldn't mind, you know, having an accelerometer that's tracking my movement so I can, you know, keep track of my fitness. But then we talked to them about that scenario where, you know, like, well, what if it was recording you late at night, or and you told your spouse that you're going to bed, but you went out to go, you know, go dancing with your friends instead. So those sorts of situations that just didn't come up just in the interview settings. So we talked about just the different aspects to that. The third formative work that we did was specifically around the design of sleep technology. So this is kind of getting at more of the physical burdens that I talked about. So we conducted a pretty large survey and interviews to determine the acceptability of putting sleep technology into the space of designing for healthy sleep. And through this, we did a literature review and talked about what the different technologies are and then looked at the space of what people said they wanted and needed and then tried to develop a framework that helps identify what those opportunities and challenges are for designing for this space. The main takeaway was wearing things to bed is really uncomfortable. People are already pretty, not everyone, but a lot of people are pretty sensitive to the things that go into their bedroom. A lot of people didn't even have TVs in there or had a rule, like no laptops in the bedroom. So you know, wearing things to bed was a problem. Also remembering to do things, so the example I gave about being groggy at night or in the morning, you know, there's a lot of times that people don't remember anything. Usually we also learned that night was a little bit better than in the morning, because if you think about things like, you know, if you write down all the stuff you need to do in the bedtime, you know, right before bed, you probably won't remember them unless you wrote them down. So morning was more challenging. And then just more of the time intensity of manual tracking was an issue as well. So that kind of, those are sort of the things that sort of set us up to try to understand these burdens at a deeper level. And so then we went through and have tried to design technologies to try and overcome some of those burdens. So any questions at this point? All right, so I'm going to talk about three different applications. Two of them are related to sleep, and one of them is related to children's development. So I'll talk about each one and discuss sort of how the burdens, we tried to address them, and the different studies that we did and how successful we were. So the first one is an application called Shut-Eye. So the goal for this one was that we've been talking with a lot of people from the medical domain and the sleep medicine domain to talk about what the different issues are related to sleep. And they said the number one thing that if someone complains of sleep problems is they try to educate them on what's called sleep hygiene. And so this is things that, you know, sleeping in a room that's dark, making sure you don't have a lot of caffeine, relaxing before bedtime, not taking in alcohol within an hour or two of bedtime, you're only taking naps in the middle of the day, and those sorts of things are sort of the first thing that people do to try and address those problems. The problem is that these are all kind of just general, generic guidelines, and it's hard to apply them in everyday situations. It's great to go, oh, cut back on caffeine. But when you really want that coffee at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's hard to remember that caffeine in that situation. But the other thing is that because it's such a kind of a first-round thing, we didn't want to have to involve any tracking. So we really wanted to pay attention to that mental effort and the time effort involved and try to reduce those burdens as much as possible. So our goal is to try and educate people on sleep hygiene, provide these sorts of reminders without any recording or documentation whatsoever. Just to give an example of some of the specific guidelines. So we took guidelines from the sleep literature. This is just a subset of them, but you know, the guidelines are things like napping is recommended, you know, 8 hours after waking to 9 hours after waking. So it's basically that siesta time, you know, right after lunch is about the recommended time. And it says only a 10 to 15 minute nap in that time frame is really the only thing you can do napping that will not have a negative impact on your sleep later on at night. Meals, the recommendation is that you shouldn't have meals within 3 hours of going to bed. Alcohol. This is a little bit counterintuitive to me, since a lot of times people think of, you know, having a glass of wine right before bed to help them go to sleep. And while that works initially, usually what happens is after the alcohol oxidizes in your body, you actually get a natural dip in your wakefulness, and it'll wake you up and disturb you for the rest of the night. So you're not supposed to have alcohol before 2 hours before bed. And then also things like the 1 hour time frame before bed is good for trying to train your body that it's time for bed. So having a routine or things like relaxation, reading a book or other things before going to bed is recommended. So our design question was, how can users be made aware of sleep-affecting activities while reducing mental, physical, and time burdens? The application we came up with was an application that runs on Android mobile phones. So it runs on the background screen of a mobile phone. It's what's called active wallpaper. So throughout the day, this display updates. So the vertical line here indicates the current time, and the horizontal bars are the different activities that I mentioned. So the first one is coffee or caffeinated beverages. The second one's napping. The third one's exercise. The fourth one's meals. Fifth one is alcohol, and the last one's relaxation. And so if the bar for a given activity is thin, that means if you did that activity right now, it would probably have a negative impact on your sleep. If it's thick, it's totally fine to do that. It's not going to have a negative impact on your sleep if you do that activity right now. And so the idea is that you can quickly look at your phone while you're checking a text message or checking email or doing other stuff with your phone and just get a quick glance and say, oh, okay, it's a little too late for coffee. I missed my nap time. Exercise, meals, and alcohol, totally fine. Not quite time to start relaxing yet. Just a funny thing that we found out is that, you know, we were just talking about things relating to sleep, but the alcohol actually started at 7 a.m. in the morning. And so a lot of our people in our study thought that we were encouraging them to drink at 7 in the morning. Just a kind of a funny thing about how, you know, designs can say one thing versus another. But this would update throughout the day. So you'd go back and look and say, like, oh, I missed my nap window. It was around that time. And looking forward, you could see when bedtime was. So the only thing that you had to do is actually set up when your normal wake time is and when your normal sleep time is. And so that was the only thing you had to do when you set that up in the beginning. We also had a way of turning on and off the different things. So if you never drank caffeine, you could remove that from the display. Same thing if you didn't use nicotine. Those you could remove from the display as well. Saw a question over there?
No,
okay, great. The other thing is that we only included the ones where there was scientific literature for the basis for the recommendation, but a lot of people might have things that they have a tendency to feel like it impacts their sleep negatively, or they might be on a medication that they know impacts their sleep. So we allowed for two custom recommendations. People added things like technology use within an hour of bedtime, so they want to turn that off, which is a little counterintuitive to using a technology app to control their technology use before bedtime. But other things were just things like surfing the internet, watching TV, video games, medications. Those are the custom things that people added. So that was the only setup there was. There wasn't anything other than that. It was kind of a set it and forget it sort of thing once you got it up and running. So we ran an initial study with this, so it was mostly qualitative in nature. We did a 4-week study with 12 participants where we put it on their primary mobile phones. So this was something that they were using all the time throughout the day. And so some of the findings that we found that people reported an increased sense of awareness. So we asked them at the beginning of the study in an interview what kinds of things that they thought impacted their sleep, and, you know, some people had some ideas, but they towards the end of it, when we did the interview, they had a much better understanding of the different ways that their sleep could be impacted. People use the shut-eye tool as sort of a motivating tool for adhering to schedules. So they thought of it almost as they were setting goals for themselves in terms of their wake-up and to bedtimes, and so they're actually kind of trying to adhere to the schedule, thinking that they were setting a goal for themselves. And then they had a better sense of the factors that influence their own sleep as well.
You may have said it and I didn't catch it, but were your participants just general participants, or were they people with identified sleep?
So the only inclusion criteria is a self-reported desire to improve their sleep. So yeah, that's the population that these sort of sleep hygiene recommendations would be targeted to. We did filter for people who had severe sleep problems. So if they had a diagnosed sleep apnea or something along those lines, since that really wasn't the target audience, we recruited for them, but it was a general population.
And how did you recruit?
So this was with the Intel Lab, and they had a professional recruiting agency. So they, you know, mostly were offered, I think, $120 gift cards, and so they recruited through the recruiting agency. So, but yeah, the only inclusion criteria was just a self-reported desire to improve their sleep and not having any diagnosed sleep problems. Good question. We didn't try to. We didn't try to, this gives a quick overview of who the participants were, so they were kind of just general public. We didn't specifically try to change their behavior with this one. It was more about promoting awareness and helping people understand that, but we tried to look for some markers of this. So we used what's called the Upworth Sleepiness Score for this particular application. And it's a scale that results in a score from about 0 to 21, and anything over that 5 to 6 range is considered, you know, not getting enough sleep or excessive sleepiness. So we asked them before and after using the application. We saw decreases in 8 of our 12 participants. 3 of the participants stayed about the same. One participant actually had a negative. It went in the other direction. And it was really interesting when we talked with her, because she basically had said, this application helped me realize that I don't care about sleep. So she's like, I want to drink. I want to, like, have meals late at night. I want to, you know, she was pretty young, you know, young college student. And so she decided that sleep was not important as a result of her app. So we did have a little bit of backfire with that. But for the most part, people liked the fact that they didn't have to do anything. And, you know, it was something they could just set and forget, didn't have to do these sorts of things. So we definitely succeeded in our goal of reducing the burdens for that. But interestingly, they all reported, like, well, it would be nice if it actually could keep track of the number of caffeinated beverages that I had. So they were kind of asking for it to be a little bit more interactive, even though a lot of the research shows that, you know, it probably wouldn't be successful if we included those things. So kind of just a lesson of be careful what you ask for, because you know, if we made them record all those things, I'm sure we'd have gotten the opposite response, like, oh, it's too much to keep track of. But without it, then they kind of wanted it as well. So there might be room to improve this sort of application, maybe having some optional recording if people wanted it to be a little bit more customized. Any other questions about Shed Eye? Yeah.
Did people express an interest for more than 2 custom?
Not really. I mean, I think only half the participants even had 1 custom thing on there. A lot of people had asked about technology because there was, I think, since we did the study, there's been new research that shows things like blue light before bed can impact it. So that might be something that we include on there. So like the blue light that can be emitted from televisions and things. That was really the only thing that people had asked about was sort of technology use. But, yeah.
Do you think if you developed on the iPhone instead of Android, you get different results?
Good question. Yeah, so we had to choose Android since there's no active wallpaper on iPhone, so it was a technology constraint on why we chose that one. In looking at sort of demographic differences, there's, you know, it's still smartphones. I think the Android sort of tend toward the geekier types, the more technology savvy types, and iPhones are kind of more. But I don't, and that's old data, and I think, I haven't seen really recent data on the differences between iPhone and Android, but. I would hope that there's no differences, but I don't know for sure.
Is it commercially available?
Yeah, you can actually go to the Google Play and download it if you want to play with it. So one of the things that we've realized is that the new resolutions on the newer phones, it kind of doesn't stretch yet, so there's a little bit of bug with it that way, but it still is totally functional if you want to go play with it. So that was Shed Eye. So that was kind of looking at how we can reduce sort of mental efforts, time efforts to try and get, you know, a difference across to these things for health technologies. The second application I want to talk about is one called Lullaby, so also relating to sleep. We had lots of fun brainstorming names for different projects relating to different, you know, terminologies relating to sleep. So this one's Lullaby. This is, again, sort of looking at this notion of sleep hygiene. So, you know, again, if someone's complaining of sleep, usually the first thing is trying to educate them on the different things that can help sleep. So Shed Eye was more about the time-based ones. Lullaby is more about the environmental-based ones. So those are the recommendations about you should sleep in a room that's fairly cool, it should be pretty dark, it should be free of noise, it should be free of distractions, you know, not keeping pets in the bed with you, not having your children in the bed with you, or all these sorts of recommendations that the sleep literature says about the sleep environment and how to make that work for you. So we wanted to help people try to understand what their sleep environment was at home, but then also help them try to understand what was actually causing their own sleep disturbances. So was it things like temperature? Was it things like light? Was it their children coming in the middle of the night with a nightmare? Was it their cat jumping on their bed? Was it their dog deciding that, you know, they wanted to sleep on the bed and stretch out like my own dog does? So it's amazing how a 45-pound dog can take up an entire bed. But you know, these are the sorts of things that can help people try and understand what is causing their sleep disruptors at night. So our design question was helping users investigate what these disruptors are in a home setting and trying to minimize the physical or privacy, physical, and time burden. So recording what goes on in your sleep environment, like I mentioned, you know, recording the bedroom has its own issues regarding to that. So we had to be really careful in making sure that this was a system that was going to be have really good privacy controls, you know, making sure that, you know, things that got recorded could be deleted easily or turned on and off pretty easily as well. We try to minimize the physical burdens of these things and also the time burden associated with them. So I'll talk about the design real quick and how we did that. So the basic idea is, you kind of saw the bigger picture before, it's about a size of a table lamp, a bedside appliance. This is a research prototype, so it's pretty ugly. We definitely would want to record, you know, make this into a prettier thing if this is actually going to go on people's bedside tables. But the display itself includes two motion sensors. One that you aim towards the bed and one that you would aim towards the door of your bedroom, and it was on a rotating pole, so you could adjust it depending on how it is. There's a pretty sensitive microphone that can sense high levels of sounds. There's a temperature sensor, a light sensor, and an infrared camera that could take snapshots of the environment every 15 seconds, so it could show what was going on in the room. There's also a tablet PC that takes the data and can visualize it. So the home screen of this is shown here. So you can get a quick view of the different environmental conditions. So if it's red, it means it's outside the recommended levels for that particular environmental factor. If it's green, you're good to go there. It shows just a last 5-minute snapshot for each thing so you can see what's going on. So for example, the recommended temperature is supposed to be between, you know, like 58 and 72 degrees. So if it's above that, it would be red. If it's below that, that would be blue. Same thing with light levels. So you get a quick snapshot. Is my room capable or good for sleeping now? Also shows what the camera is currently showing up there in the corner. It's a kind of fisheye lens with an infrared camera. You can quickly turn on and off the recording. You can separately turn on and off the camera as well. So if you're more sensitive to the camera and the microphone recording, then you can turn that off independently of all the sensors being turned off. There's also a way to quickly delete the last hour of recording. So if things happen in bed and you decide that you don't want that, you can quickly delete it without doing much further beyond that. We also had a way of deleting more, which I'll show you in a second. The idea is that what you had to do was record your previous night's sessions. So what we end up with is a recorded night of sleep. So we had users wear the Fitbit tracking tool for tracking their sleep, which I know has its own issues related to that. But for a 2-week period, people were willing to put up with some of those things in terms of using that to track their sleep. So what you end up with is a visualization here that shows their awakenings over time. So this is about, this goes from midnight to 8 a.m. So it's about an 8-hour time window of someone's sleep. And so we get a visualization of all the different sensors associated with that, as well as their different awakenings. And so the idea is you can quickly look and say, like, okay, the things, you know, try and line up, you know, the things that are helping me or awakening me at night, you can click on those and show what was going on. So it might be hard to tell just from a visualization of the data. So if you click the little play button, you can go and show the recording from what happened at that time. So you can quickly access what happened at that particular awakening. So this is, I apologize, you can't see it too much. You know, you put the person in bed there. the projector's a little bit dark down here. But you can go back and play the snapshots of what was going on with the camera view, and then play back the audio as well.
So Jill, this is an actual one.
What's that?
This is an actual recording of a real person.
Yeah, so this was one of our study participants' sleep. So
why do you think the person was waking up?
So it's interesting. So you'll know it's August 8th, so it's summer. The person didn't have air conditioning. It was actually pretty warm. So you can see throughout the night there's a lot of, you know, it turns red when it's outside the recommended levels. And so there's a lot of red going on in the temperature time frame. They sleep in the darkness, so it wasn't, you know, the light didn't change at all throughout the whole, you know, they went to bed at midnight and woke up around 8 a.m. I guess they might have, I think she had dark curtains in her room, so there wasn't any light that was coming in above the threshold. And you see a lot of motion here, too. So this is actually, she had turned on a fan, a rotating fan, and so that was actually blowing things around in her room. And so you know, throughout the night, you kind of see this motion going on in their room. And she was still awakening several times throughout the night. So it's kind of just using visual inspection for these things. We experimented with taking some of the data and mocking up visualizations in terms of looking at correlations. So it looks like every time it's warm in your room, there's an increase in the number of awakenings. So we played with that sort of feedback there. But it's kind of hard to know exactly what to visualize. So this is still in progress in terms of what we're going to do for summary feedback. But for right now, it's sort of on an independent level. The Fitbit recorded an awakening. So there's some limitations to that in that it's accelerometer based, and so it's on their wrist. And so if they're a really restless sleeper, then it might have just been they kind of got up and moved around a little bit. This is unfortunately kind of still the gold standard for assessing sleep in the home. It took about 20 years for the sleep community to accept it's a somewhat acceptable form of recording, but there's still some limitations for that as well. So as I mentioned, there's a quick way to quickly delete scenes that have gotten recorded. So each of these represents a 15-minute chunk of time, so they can quickly drag their finger across it and delete a whole chunk of data if they want to. It turns out sleep data looks all very similar throughout the night, so it's the reason why a snapshot every 15 seconds is more useful for that. So we did another deployment study with this one. So we did a 2-week study with 4 participants. This was a lot more effort to kind of go and put things into people's bedrooms. The nice thing is that a lot of times we don't know how long to run these sorts of studies, but the sleep literature is pretty clear that a 2-week snapshot is a good good sampling of how long it takes to kind of get a good understanding of someone's sleep habits. So anytime they do a baseline study with sleep, 2 weeks is about the time. So it's nice to have that sort of guidance for once. So some of our overall findings was we saw pretty high access throughout the study. So we thought maybe lots of people would use it right just in the beginning and then kind of forget about it. But we saw pretty much most of our participants are accessing it pretty frequently throughout the entire 2-week study. One of our participants discovered she's actually coughing in her sleep. So she kept seeing a lot of spikes and a noise on there and went and investigated and went and listened to the recording and she heard herself coughing. So that was great because that's actually a possible sign of sleep apnea. So she decided to go follow up with that as a result of being in our study. One of our participants also discovered he was sleepwalking. So he'd woken up in the morning and the door to his bedroom was shut. And he said he always sleeps with his door shut. He always sleeps with his door open, and he was confused about why it was shut in the morning. So he went and looked at the lullaby recording, saw a bunch of activity around like 2 or 3 in the morning, went back and played it. Sure enough, he'd gotten up in the middle of the night. The cat had gotten into his room, and it was somehow maybe bothering him. You could see some rustling in there. Kicked the cat out, shut the door, had no memory of it actually happening. And so this happened a couple of times in the 2-week period, so it was really interesting that he was able to open it. He didn't know that he did this, so it's great. Yeah.
Did any participants have any object any about privacy?
Yeah, I'm actually going to get to that 1 second. So, good question, since we're trying to minimize the privacy burden with that. So, this is a chromogram visualizing their access over time. So, the light blue indicates their sleep periods. And the home screen, that's shown in the home screen, is displayed as this darker blue. The history screen is the green. And the delete screen is the red. So the history screen is kind of the accessing and going back and playing back the data. So you can see it was actually used pretty frequently throughout the whole 2-week period for almost all our participants. So usually you might see like a bunch of use in the beginning and then nothing, and then right before you're about to go interview them because the study's over, you might go see that as well. We actually saw pretty frequent use throughout almost every night in most cases. So the red indicates the delete screen. So we didn't ask them. We showed them their data, and we said, do you want to share anything about deleting? And the first participant said that she's changed in her bedroom. So every night before she went to bed, this was caught on the camera, and she went back and deleted it. So that was one. This guy here had his wife, and they shared a bed, and they would often have private conversations in bed before going to sleep. So they'd go back and his wife is actually really glad to be done with the study because she kept saying, can you delete what we just said? She'd been venting about a coworker, before going to bed at night, so he had to go back and delete that. And this guy here, was very, very open about the reason why he deleted these two segments and really, really embarrassed my poor student whose face turned really red. He's very open about it, but there are definitely some concerns. But people seem to be okay with it in general, and felt that they had adequate control over their recorded data. This is also just a result of being in the study. If this was for personal use, then people may be less likely to delete the data. But for the most part, it was only in those high need cases that they were trying to delete any of that data there. So we felt that that was actually pretty good that we'd been able to mitigate some of those concerns. But again, if you know, participant two was willing to tell us about these things, maybe he doesn't care about privacy as much as other people might. So I gotta take it with a grain of salt a little bit. So our next steps for this is that we're working with some people in rehabilitative medicine to deploy this for people with multiple sclerosis. So a lot of times they have a lot of sleep issues associated with their pain, and so we're also going to combine a pain log with this as well, so people can record over time the different pain that they have associated with that. We're also interested, like I mentioned, we've been playing with different mock-ups in terms of how to summarize this data. So right now we're kind of just presenting it as is, but is there a way to present overall summary data in terms of, you know, lights, you know, the impact of light or the impact of temperature, the impact of noise on the environment? Because for some people, some of these things mattered a lot. So for example, the person who was coughing at night, you know, noise was actually important for her. But for her, light was completely useless. She usually slept during, you know, like a 10 to 6 a.m. time period, which there's no light in, you know, in her bedroom whatsoever. For the other person, the camera and the movement detection was more important, but for him, it seems like he could sleep no matter how much light was in the room, so it wasn't as important for him. Other limitations were things like the temperature. You know, the person had turned on the fan, so she felt cooler, but our readings showed that it was still warm in the room because the temperature sensor is not actually sensitive to the fact that, you know, a fan makes people feel cooler. It was still actually hot in the room. And also we experiment with things like air quality monitors to see if air quality has an impact. But those devices themselves actually make quite a bit of noise. So in our early prototypes, we decided to take those out of there because we didn't want to actually cause more sleep disturbances than we were actually producing there. But any questions about Lullaby? Okay. So next I'm going to move on to a different domain that we've been working on and a different set of burdens that we've tried to reduce through technology design. And that's moving on to the area of children's development. So this project is called Baby Steps. It's a project that I've been working on since, I think, about 2007, so it's been ongoing for quite a while. The goal with this is that I'm working with a statewide initiative for the state of Washington that is trying to scan and screen every single child through age 5 in the state of Washington. And connect them to early intervention services regardless of their background, income levels, or residency status, access to health insurance, all those sorts of things. So right now there's a statewide database for vaccination records so that any time a child is vaccinated that goes to a database that can be looked up by doctors or health clinics. They'd like to put something in place that also does developmental screening. And so what do I mean by screening? So kind of one of the more popular examples of this is a set of 22 different questionnaires spread out across a 5-year period, asking if children have met 30 different milestones per questionnaire. So they're in 5 different categories, so things like gross motor, fine motor, communication skills, social skills, and personal social, or problem solving skills as well. So for example, one of these milestones is, you know, at 8 months, does Samuel turn his head in the direction of a loud noise? So if he's not doing that by about 8 months, that could be a sign of hearing loss, or possibly a social disorder like autism. So looking for things like that. Also at 14 months, does Sally play with a doll or stuffed animal by hugging it? So that's kind of showing that they've been picking up on social cues. That can also be the sign of a social disorder, something like autism as well. And then by 2 years, can Aisha kick a ball by swinging her foot? So if she's not able to do that, it could be a sign of a physical disability. So there's 30 of these types of questions that parents are expected to answer pretty frequently in the beginning, so every 2 months for the first year or so, and then tapering out to about every 6 months by years 3 and 4. And so if they're not meeting these milestones on right, then they might want to be, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a problem, it could be a sign of it. So the idea is that if they're screened and fall below a certain threshold for development, then they could be connected to special services who would then do the full assessment and diagnosis and follow up with them for screening, or follow up for them for care. So our design question here was, how can technology support tracking developmental milestones for every child in Washington State over a period of 5 years in a way that sort of reduces the emotional and financial burdens? So as I mentioned, you know, learning about these things can be difficult for a parent to learn that their child might not be developing on track for things. Then the fact that the state of Washington wants to reach every single child means that we have some financial issues to think about as well, because from what they've been telling me and from what our user research tells me, a lot of the kind of high SES kids are getting screened multiple times, and it's the kids who are from, you know, different cultural backgrounds or don't have quite the same access to healthcare, the ones that are slipping through the cracks. And so they're the ones that we want to target the most for this. So it's pretty daunting to think about how is a system that every single child in the state is going to be using. So rather than one system to do this, we decided that we should have sort of a no wrong door approach to this. So, sorry, I swear I'm not touching it, it's possessed. So our approach to this was to build an ecosystem of tools that could help people use any technology that they're comfortable with or familiar with to get this information into the central database. So for this particular design problem, we're only concerned about the front end of this. How do we get the database? So the statewide initiative is working on what to do once that information is in there. So they've got a whole protocol for following up with people, doing follow-up phone calls, connecting them to health care providers, connecting them to the special services. So we were looking at just the problem of taking the information and getting it into the database. So through a lot of user research we did with different cultures, we were specifically looking at Latino populations, for example, because they were a good cross-section of the population that had varying levels of income, as well as cultural issues, as well as different access to technology. So we used them as sort of a case study for trying to develop the different types of tools that we might be able to do. And we came up with six different approaches on how people might get this information into the database. So we have a text messaging-based approach to people if they don't have access to a computer, but they do have access to a cell phone, and they can receive text messages answering those questions through that. We have a web portal that allows them to enter it through the web. People can get information through Facebook updates, so if they can see a question, they follow the Facebook page and respond that way. We have a public kiosk, so we're talking with some of the public health clinics that are experimenting with these in their waiting rooms to answer health-based questionnaires through that. We've been talking to people about face-to-face technologies. So right now, one of the strategies that people use is to go door-to-door in migrant communities and have a paper-based system where they go and answer the questions about people and take this information. So it's obviously pretty cumbersome to take a bunch of paper surveys of people who have gone door-to-door. So we've been looking at designing an iPad-based application to enter in information that way to get that up into the database. And then updates through Twitter as well. So just to kind of give you an overview of it, so these are all still being developed in progress, so I'll give you a quick snapshot of where we are with this. But in thinking about reducing emotional burdens, we wanted to present this as not so much of a medical tool as much of sort of a celebration of the things that your child does. So in a lot of our user research, we learned that parents are already tracking a lot of things like your child's first word or first steps or rolling over. Have a 5-month-old right now, and every time she does something, it's like a new celebration. So we're trying to take advantage of the fact that people are already sort of tracking these things. So the web-based system allows you to track the milestone-based questions, but then also things like emotional or sentimental records as well. So things like experience finger pain or their first haircut or the trip to the zoo or trip to grandmother's house. So there's a timeline view where you can record these things over time and answer these questions as sort of a way of doing sharing this over time. We have a way of sharing this publicly with people, so you can share this with grandparents or remote friends and family who want to see what's going on with their child but maybe don't want everything posted to their Facebook newsfeed. So they can actually go through and view everything that's been going on in a way there. They can add new memories. We have the questionnaires built into the system, so when they answer the questionnaires through the website, they can post it to the timeline and share that with people that way, so they can quickly answer the questionnaires that we want to use that way. So we also have a Twitter-based prototype that we're using as well. So the idea for this one is that, website, how many people go to their website? The same website every year for 5 years. You're probably not going to go to it pretty regularly. So the idea is to try and get people thinking about this over time, even if they're not going back to the website. So for this, we have a Twitter-based tool where you can follow the birth month of when your child was born. So for example, my daughter was born in November 2012, so I follow the Baby Steps November 2012 feed. And about once every day or two, I might see a message like this. So does your baby turn his or her head in the direction of a loud noise with a code word and a hashtag, so that's associated with that particular milestone. Then I can respond back to that and say, yes, my daughter's name turns her head in the direction of a loud noise, and then repeat that code word back there. So all our system cares about is the things with hashtags. So that does it include yes, does it include the child's name, and does it include the milestone key. anything else with them. They can shorten it however they want. They can rephrase it. You know, we don't care about the rest of that. We also have a way of going to the system and making a pseudonym for your child's name. So if you didn't want to share their real name on there, you know, baby one or baby two. We learned that a lot of mommy bloggers don't name their kids by name, so they actually just want to say baby one or baby two. So you can actually respond either publicly to your whole Facebook feed, or you can do a direct reply as well, so you don't necessarily have to post everything out to your entire 12,000 followers or however many people have these days. So I do have a friend that has like 20,000 followers. It's crazy. And she has an 8-month-old, and she has tweeted about him. So that way you can kind of have the choice of making it both public or private. And so that's kind of targeting a certain demographic of the population. And then we also have a way of targeting some of these different demographics as well. So the Twitter-based tool, we had an approach where it was kind of pinging people every couple of days or so to try to get them interested in using the system. We also have an SMS-based system where you can take the questionnaires entirely through text messaging. So the idea is that you'd receive the messages through text message, and you can reply yes, Y for yes, S for sometimes, or no for not yet. This is actually a little bit different too. So based on our user research, we thought, we could send one message every day and then they can respond to it. But talking with a lot of people who use prepaid cell phone plans, which is who we'd be targeting, a lot of times they may change phone numbers, or they may turn their phone off for long periods of time because they don't want to get phone calls and use up their minutes. So for this, we decided that once we kind of get them responding to the system, we'll immediately send the next question right away. So they can conceivably take the entire questionnaire in one sitting if they wanted to, just the text messaging based system. If they don't respond right away, then we'll ping them again and 2 days later with the same question. So we have a whole flow chart for how to design these messages through here. So right now for our study, we're going to reimburse people for messages, but there's been a precedent for getting carriers for these sorts of things to actually comp the messages and make them free text messages. So Text for Baby, for example, is a service, a public health messaging system you can sign up. It's all one way. It doesn't do responses, but you can, if you sign up for that, it's no charge there. Yeah.
How uneasy do parents get if they have to answer no?
Yeah, good question. So we're going to find out. So our next step is to do finalize the development for all the prototypes for the technologies, and we're about to start an 18-month trial with 40 families. So we're doing some pilot testing with there in the start. And you're right, people don't like necessarily say no to a lot of these things. So the surveys are built in that you can say no to many of them and still be fine. Because they'll start asking questions, and then they'll ask them again over like a 5-month period, because the questionnaires are designed to account for variability. And so it's towards the end that they're answering no to these things constantly over a 5-month period when it becomes a problem. So we've got some text built into the website in terms of where to go for information if they're concerned. We've got a lot of resources there that they can go up and look at that as well if they're concerned. We're also asking them to opt in to follow-up phone calls, so and giving them a resource line that they can go and call if they have questions about this. So again, this is part of the statewide initiative for that. But it's a hard design problem. We've experimented with different ways. Should we visualize the data over time? Most of the people we talk to, most of the parents we talk to are interested in maybe seeing that data, but more from a vanity perspective. So saying, a lot of parents know what their percentiles are for height and weight, but they're also like, I want to know if my child's like 99th percentile for personal, for personal and social skills. And it's hard because we don't want to encourage that behavior where people are getting super competitive, but at the same time, we don't want to hide that information either. So right now, our approach is that, once the data is into the system, we provide a message that says, thanks, this information will be, you'll be able to follow up with this through the system, share this information with your doctor if you have any concerns, and then some messages about saying no to things as normal. So those are just the languages, the moves that we have, but we'll see how well it works. So far, pilot testing seems to be okay for that, but over time, people might start to think about it there. So we don't know that we have the right answer, but we're hopefully trying to make it more of a celebratory thing as opposed to a medical-based thing that hopefully we can mitigate some of that, but I think in general there'll be some of that as well. So, yeah, Wanda?
Are you using it for Maya? Have you discovered anything?
It's still a little bit buggy, so I've been using the system for recording these things so far, but it's crashed a couple times. So hopefully by the end of the summer, when we're about to launch our study, I'll be able to use it more robustly. But I have the paper based questionnaires. I've been tracking in there, so I can go back and enter it back into the system. But yeah, good question.
Do you ever translate it into other languages?
Yeah. So the tools are there's a Spanish language version as well as I think they're working on Vietnamese and some other languages as well. For our study, we're just looking at, does this approach even work to begin with? So we're focusing on just English language at this time. But conceivably, if this approach works, then we might be able to do it for other languages. Yep.
Totally a little off topic, but for the Twitter stuff, I know there's been some work in like disaster response, for coming up with like a structured syntax.
Yep.
Are you trying to find, are there any parallels, overlaps?
Yeah, so...